Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. I was thinking this morning that this is a very tough time for people who do parody, because how do you top reality? How do you do better than what happened yesterday, where you had the President of the United States go to a mask factory and he's doing a tour while they are, and I'm not making this up, this is not a parody. While they were blaring in the background the song Live and Let Die. Do we have a little bit of the audio of that? So this actually happened. This actually happened in real time. Jimmy Kimmel had a great tweet. He said, "I can think of no better metaphor for this presidency than Donald Trump not wearing a face mask to a face mask factory while the song Live and Let Die blares in the background." Oh, jeez, you cannot make this up. Jonathan Allen from NBC News. Do you ever have this feeling that, like, how do you keep up with it?
All day, every day. it's pretty amazing. You know, we went from impeachment to a pretty crowded Democratic primary to the biggest crisis this country's ever faced, and certainly in my lifetime, on a public health scale, combined with the biggest economic crisis it's faced in my lifetime, for sure, and at least dating back to basically that same period of time on either side of the roaring 20s.
Okay, so three words for you, though, because everybody's going, well, it can't get worse than this. It just can't. There's nothing more. You know, season three is completely booked. Three words, Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Didn't the entire country go, oh, my God, when there was a report that she's back in the hospital with an infection? I mean, you know, prayers and everything, but, you know, We can't take one more thing. I mean, we can't take it. Jonathan, I'm sorry.
I mean, Charlie, I mean, I have to say that, like, number one, the idea that that the prospect of the court becoming more conservative would be scary to conservatives a couple of years ago is amazing to me. You know what I mean? That like, I think that there was a time not so long ago where a lot of people who I listen to and read would have said, good, the court's going to get more conservative. And
yeah.
I mean, I don't mean from the perspective of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's current health situation, but I mean sort of broadly and generally that the court could get more conservative. And right now, what I hear from a lot of these folks is, oh my God, the court could get more conservative, which I think is interesting. But separate from that, I think everybody obviously wants Ruth Bader Ginsburg to be healthy. You know, I don't think anybody ever wants to see a Supreme Court vacancy, no matter. Hopefully, nobody ever wants to see a vacancy created because of death. You know, rather than the justice deciding for towards higher. But from a news events perspective, a Supreme Court appointment fight to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg. No,
we don't need it. Somebody said this would break our democracy or something. And I said, well, not that it's not broken already, but the prospect of going through this would be like Kavanaugh. What's beyond squared? It's like exponentially worse than Kavanaugh in the midst of a presidential campaign, in the midst of the Great Depression, in the midst of the pandemic. The United States Senate, debating this over Zoom? I can't.
Throw in the likelihood that the choice for a replacement for her would be the least qualified person and most loyal person possible, right? Like what we have seen from a lot of the recent judicial appointments, and then this doesn't apply to Gorsuch or Kavanaugh, but what we've been seeing with the sort of packing of the court with folks who don't have deep experience on the bench lately suggests that you want, and by the way, both sides are doing, at least at this level, some of this. You're going to find the youngest person you possibly can who can stick around for the longest possible, which means you're probably finding somebody who is less qualified which means that the fight over it's going to be obscenely ugly.
Beyond anything that we've ever seen. So speaking of coping mechanisms, hey, great respect. You actually did one of the TV shows via Skype recently. And you actually had the bourbon and rye like right there behind you. See, everybody else is like lining up all the books and everything and their medals and trophies and stuff. You had the booze right there.
The executive producer of the show sent me the screenshot with the booze circled. And of course, you know, you can't really, I can't see what the shot looks like until they actually connect. And I had asked an assistant who's smaller than I am to move alcohol away from the area behind me, and it did not get moved far enough away, so it did in fact appear in the shot.
Well, now do I also notice that you have gone through you went through the coronavirus quarantine beard, and the beard's gone now, right?
That's right. Okay. My wife insisted.
Okay, no, see, I actually did that for a little while, and then I literally got up at 1:30 in the morning and said I can't take it anymore, and I had to shave it off. But I did that. That was no big deal. I raised this question because it's like how long are we into all this now? I've lost track of all time. 6 weeks or so.
Yeah, maybe so, seven. Depends so, on.
Yeah, yesterday Amazon.com delivered to me the 13 part Norelco personal shaver, now which is also cuts your hair, does all that other awesome stuff. And I'm looking at it going, what could go wrong? I mean, really, what could go wrong? I mean, cutting your own hair. I don't know. I just, at the end of this, everybody can share stories about, did you cut your own hair? Did you trust your wife to cut your hair? Did somebody else do it? So I posted that on Twitter last night, and people actually started posting pictures of some really bad experiences. I mean, you have guys who've never dealt with one of these hair razor things before, and to say that lots can go wrong very, very quickly. But the good news, let's focus on the good. The good news is your hair always grows back, right?
So, I mean, you know, usually.
Well, usually. Speaking of other good news, Jared Kushner apparently has a new job. He's going to be in charge of finding the vaccine. So I'm feeling better. You feeling better? America feeling better?
Well, Jared Kushner has often claimed success that doesn't exactly match reality. If you got to be careful,
that's true.
If you success upon a vaccine, will it be like Middle East peace, or will it be like this coronavirus task force so far that hasn't actually been as successful as he's claimed?
Yeah, the story, and it's the New York Times, right? The story about the 20-something volunteer task force that was such a joke that somebody actually filed a whistleblower complaint that, look, these are really, really smart people, but they just have no idea what they're doing, as if having some experience and knowledge would be relevant at a time like this.
Right. I mean, I've looked at a map. That doesn't make me a diplomat.
it doesn't.
And, you know, I know some people who are doctors. That doesn't make me an epidemiologist.
So, you know, a little bit earlier, Don, I was mentioning how hard it is to keep up. And I wrote my newsletter this morning, and I was writing about what it meant that the president was winding down the coronavirus task force, even as we're getting these new projections that we're entering into a new phase. And this was mission unaccomplished. And the moment, it felt like the moment I pressed send on the newsletter, we see this tweet from the president saying, oh, no, never mind. Even though I'd confirmed the story yesterday, the coronavirus task force will go on indefinitely. So give me your sense of what's going on there. Yesterday, apparently it was, yes, it's time to wind it down. It's time to move on. It's time to shift the focus. Today, he's tweeting out, no, it goes on indefinitely. So where are we at?
And then you have to take a step back and look at what all of the outcomes say together, which is the president is trying to have as much possible power over the scarce goods that are available, as much of an ability to claim that he is helping in place A, B, C, or D, and at the same time completely get rid of any accountability or responsibility for the outcomes going forward. And so he's trying to do that by moving things over to the states as much as possible and saying it's up to governors to open or not open. And then B, within the federal government to move those responsibilities straight to the agencies. And part of that is it's not exactly disbanding the task force, but it is giving it a much lower profile. And one of the things that we know is going on from some of the reporting we've done at NBC and others have reported is this move out of FEMA and to HHS so that they, that's the Department of Health and Human Services, so that there's more of a control under an agency that the president has. I don't know. He just put Michael Caputo, one of his longtime spokesmen, in charge of communications over there. I mean, I think they're trying to bring things in.
Yeah, well, Michael, I mean, the Caputo appointment, like the appointment of the new press secretary, it is interesting that they're actually going out and getting people whose main qualification seems to be that they were internet trolls. But no, I think you're exactly right here. Clearly, whatever happens to the task force, the president is he's the executive producer of the Trump show, right? And he wants this revamp. He wants to shift the scene from all the worried doctors and everybody to these upbeat episodes of economic revival. So by pushing the task force aside, he kind of sends the message to his base that, hey, we've turned the corner. We're winning this, which they're not necessarily doing it. And as you point out, really does shift the buck, the responsibility back on to the governors. And I think it's interesting. So the president is kind of, you know, running away from the fight, but in the show he's creating in his mind, he's the war leader, right? He had that quote yesterday that the people of our country should think of themselves as warriors. Warriors. Yes. Go to Arby's. Land, you know, storm the beach, I guess.
Well, I mean, the sort of scary thing about that right now is that the people of the United States are showing up at their state governments' headquarters, whether it's, you know, the legislature or other spots where state governments gather, you know, governors' mansions and stuff, protesting armed with masks, which, you know, in theory isn't such a big deal, except for that we are kind of on the cusp of social breakdown, and the combination of wearing masks for protection from spread of disease versus for protection from being identified by authorities is a very sort of confusing thing. But I think for a lot of Americans, regardless of what their political stripes are, the prospect of police and state governments clashing with like armed marauders in the middle of a pandemic is, you know, unsettling.
A little bit. I mean, this whole, I think one of the more tragic aspects of this, and I know I'm misusing the word tragic, is the way that the face mask has become a symbol as opposed to a tool, that somehow some folks on the right, you know, FreedomWorks has a tweet out this morning or yesterday saying forced face masking is a civil rights offense. Well, no. Governments do have the power to confront pandemics. Private companies can set rules for what you have to wear, you know, the no shirt, no shoes, no service sort of thing. And then just quite frankly, this the reason that people wear masks is because they don't want to infect other people. So there's a certain element of this. But yeah, it is the cognitive dissonance is really bizarre. Now, you mentioned that we're seeing these protests, but we're also getting these surveys, these polls, which still suggest there are partisan divides, and I want to come back to that in a moment, but that the vast majority of Americans are still more worried about health than the economy. So where is public opinion on this? I mean, we see the pictures of the people doing the jailbreak and going out and not doing the social distancing, and yet you get this survey from the University of Maryland, which would suggest super majorities saying that, no, we're still comfortable with stay-at-home orders.
I mean, I think the one thing that you have a lot of difficulty putting a price on, no matter who you are, is your own life. To try to put some sort of economic dollar value on that. It's one of the reasons that our healthcare system is so expensive. People will continue to seek out whatever cure they can find. They will get a second or third or fifth opinion. So it's not surprising to me that the public health aspect of this is something that is scarier to people than the risk of economic disruption, particularly in a country that is doing what it can to suggest that it is going to backstop the economy at large, but also to provide some money to individuals. I mean, you know, I think that the $10 billion roughly that the Fed is pumping into investor stability pales in, or makes the money that people are getting at an individual level pale in comparison. I mean, I think the exacerbation of wealth disparity during this time is going to end up being one of those stories that we missed at the time and will be huge afterward.
I agree. And by the way, you said 10 billion. You meant 10 trillion.
I'm sorry.
Right?
I said billion. Yeah. Yes. 10 trillion. Well,
but I mean, that underlies how incredible the numbers are, because I have to think, like, are we really talking about $10 trillion? Yeah. We're taking care of the investors. We're taking care of the corporations. We're taking care of all of that while people are looking at the calendar thinking, am I going to be able to pay my utility bill and my rent bill?
But at the same time, that those same people looking at the calendar going like, if the value of, you know, if my rent bill and my utility bill are things that I can't pay, and some investors getting bailed out right now, am I more or less likely to want to get out of the house at the risk of death? Because the one thing that I still have that is of value at moment is my life. And my family, and, you know, and so I just think that I think for almost every individual, if you're faced with the choice of working or dying or the risk of dying, if you work, you know, unless you're forced to work right now, or you feel like you're not going to be able to feed your family, you're going to stay inside.
Yeah. Let me play for you a little clip from President Trump sat down with David Muir from ABC News, and Muir asked him, well, if we go ahead and we open up the country, you know, more people will more people die? And the striking answer was, and we're seeing this from Chris Christie and also from the president, that they're going, yeah, we're willing, but it's worth the trade-off. So let's play that soundbite.
It's possible there will be some, because you won't be locked into an apartment or a house or whatever it is. But at the same time, we're going to practice social distancing, we're going to be washing hands, we're going to be doing a lot of the things that we've learned to do over the last period of time. And we have to get our country back. You know, people are dying the other way too. When you look at what's happened with drugs, it goes up. When you look at suicides, I mean, take a look at what's going on. People are losing their jobs. We have to bring it back, and that's what we're doing.
Okay, Jonathan Allen, that's going to appeal to a large segment of the electorate, isn't it?
It's going to appeal to a large segment of the electorate, but it's going to appeal in a lot of cases to a segment of the electorate that's going to make noise on Twitter, but won't actually leave its house. Like, when you show me the people who are the biggest advocates of repealing stay-at-home orders in the government and in the Washington, sort of ecosystem and on Wall Street, when you show me them walking into malls, when you show me them going to stadiums, it will make it a lot easier for me to believe that they think anything other than if other people die so that the economy can stay where it is, if other people die so that me and my friends can do okay, you know, that'll be more convincing than tweets. And, you know, what the president is saying basically when he talks about those trade-offs is that people are going to die because of economic hardship. At some level, that's up to him. It's not entirely up to him. It's up to him. It's up to Congress. It's up to the Federal Reserve. But it's up to our public health system. But the truth is, if what he's arguing is that economic hardship is going to kill everyone, and in much bigger numbers, two things. One, again, he has control over that, some level of control over that. And two, I think most people would rather take their chances with an economic hardship problem that they can see and try to control themselves than a pandemic disease that they can't see and can't control themselves. It's like, you know, people are afraid of flying because they think the plane might crash. And they have no control over that plane, whereas as opposed to a car, where they're much more likely to die, They're comfortable with that because they feel like they have some control over the outcome.
Well, I my big fear is, as you look at the numbers and the attitudes, that you will have, you know, half the country, 40% of the country basically decide that, you know what, it's not that dangerous. It's been overblown. I'm going to go out. I'm going to live my life. I'm going to assert my freedom. That at a certain point, Americans just are tired of staying at home. I hope you're right about this. But the problem is that in order to get this under control, you have to have pretty much everybody buying into it. And it's very clear that everybody is not buying into it. And I think that that's going to get much more extreme, particularly as the president feels the need to change the channel on all of this.
And I'm not as much of a political scientist as I would like to be. That is to say, I didn't do as well in school as I would have liked. But I feel like there are social science and political science explanations for the phenomenon of people acting in group behavior in ways that are helpful for the group or not helpful for the group, and then making individual decisions that are bad for the group. We're going to see that. I mean, we're already seeing it, and people were on beaches and they will be on beaches again. But my question is, how many, what percentage are going to do that? And how long will other folks stay at home? I mean, I'm not going to go out and mix in any normal way anytime soon. I don't want to hurt my kids. I don't want to hurt my wife. I don't want to hurt my you know, in-laws or my parents, you know, this is going to be, let's put it this way. The warnings for the president that he's getting from inside his task force are dire about what will happen if the stay-at-home rules are relaxed now.
You touched on something that I think is very, very important, which is that this whole idea that, you know, we need to go out and be warriors. Well, going out and putting an elderly person at risk or somebody who has a compromised immune system at risk, that is not the definition of a warrior. This is not about your own personal courage. Am I personally worried about getting it? Actually, not that much. But I also know that if I am reckless and irresponsible, I will put my wife at risk. I will put other people at risk. And I don't know that I could live with myself. And this is what I have to tell you, that as somebody who was on talk radio for many, many years, I'm listening to, you know, people who are doing it. And I have to keep in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, are they aware that their words and their message could cause people to act in a reckless way that will cost the lives of innocent people? And I understand the people are fighting and that, you know, red versus blue, but there is a fundamental responsibility that kicks in because we're all human beings. Okay, I want to switch from this to get, because you are the political guy, and your book was, I think your book was one of the very first books to come out after 2016 shattered. I want to get your sense of where are we at now in this presidential race? And I'm asking this because, you know, I was thinking back on your book and the post-traumatic stress disorder that everybody experienced after the 2016 election, that people no longer trust polls. They no longer trust pundits. They just, there's a changed perception. So having gone through that, where do you think we are?
I think more than any other campaign in the history of our country, this is going to be a referendum on the incumbent because he is such a dominant force right now and for the foreseeable future in terms of actually being on television, dictating what everyone else is talking about. And his opponent is not out there as much. And to the extent that he is out there, he's very reactive. And so that doesn't mean that Trump is going to win and Biden's going to lose. I just think that this is going to be a referendum on Trump even more than it otherwise would have been, which is saying a lot. And I also think that you have seen in the past, certainly in 2016, my co-author Amy Parnes and I wrote about how the candidate who had the most focus on them in 2016 was actually the one who would do worse in the polls. The whole idea was to get the other person, to get your opponent to be the focus of attention, because that was driving people away from them. And so there's a part of me that wonders if that's, you know, the Titanic risk to Donald Trump is that the attention is completely on him and that he fails to convince people that he deserves a second term.
So let me bounce another theory of this race off you, Jonathan, which is that it's really remarkably steady. That if you look at the polls, you see the electorate has been frozen in place and the numbers just do not move. And so if you look at last year's polls, Biden's up about 6 points. Look at the polls now, aggregate them over time. Biden's up about 6 points. There's just not a lot of swing voters there. So in fact, although obviously everything that we're experiencing is unpredictable, that maybe this race is not as unpredictable as people think. I know that's kind of an outlier thing, but there is a remarkable stability in these numbers that maybe we tend to discount them.
I mean, there's a level of polarization in our country right now that feels like Civil War level. Not to say that we're on the cusp of Civil War. There's obviously a lot of other factors that go into that, including that our regions are not as pronounced as they once were, but the issues are obviously very different. But I think the level of polarization is unbelievably deep, and I think that's why you see what you point out there, Charlie, which is stability to the race. It only moves within certain kind of markers, within certain guidelines, and the president does a little better, he does a little worse, Biden does a little better, does a little bit worse, but for the most part, people are very much decided. Whether that stays the case over the course of time or not is the unpredictable part. I like to believe, because history shows it, that human behavior is not static, and human opinion, public opinion is not necessarily static. And so even though we've seen people locked in, that doesn't mean that will continue to be the case over time. I think the president's handling of this episode, whether it is seen as something heroic or something villainous, is going to define how at least the percentage of persuadable voters, however small it may be, see him. Because this is the real life test of the hypothetical: can this person running for president handle a crisis?
Well, exactly. Okay, so let me give you another possible take on this, that we are in complete denial because we still suffer from PTSD from 2016, that if you woke up after a, medically induced coma for the last 3 years, and we're told that Donald Trump is going to be running for president, or any president is going to be running for re-election with 10% or more unemployment in the midst of a pandemic like this, wouldn't we say that is the exact formula for someone not winning re-election? Donald Trump's one big thing was the economy. And by the way, when I say above 10%, we don't know. I mean, we got some numbers today suggesting that 20 million Americans have lost their jobs in the last few weeks. So, I mean, I know we know that unpredictable things can happen, but a president to be reelected in the midst of a depression era economy, if you go back to the fundamentals, wouldn't we say, yeah, that's not going to happen?
Yeah, I mean, if you'd asked me that 3 years ago, I would have told you there's no way. I do think that people are willing to forgive Trump the economic hardship, because I think they understand that this was not of his doing. I think they understand that the stay-at-home orders and the guidelines that came out from the White House were very much against his instincts on an economic level. I mean, he did it, and then he suddenly was like, let's open up by Easter. I mean, he fought his own gut on this quite a lot, and there would be an economic calamity regardless of what he did. I think part of the question is what is the response going to be to how he tried to save the economy and who he saved and what the priorities were there. And I think that the Democrats will, if they're smart, will try to make a double case. Number one, that the economy sucks and the president's responsible for that, even if he's not. And two, that he chose the wrong people to help. But I think my sense is that he will get some latitude on the economic part. I think what he's not going to get latitude on is the public health part. And I think that he's made the calculation that the economy will be the overarching issue. And I'm just not sure that's true.
Well, the other reason that's got me thinking along these lines are these polls that we're seeing out of the Senate races around the country, some rather remarkable numbers. I think there's been an assumption that the Democrats were well positioned in places like Colorado, but now we're seeing some remarkable numbers out of Montana, out of North Carolina, out of Iowa. So, which would also suggest to me that the ground may be shifting. So, give me your sense of that. The U.S. Senate is in play in a way that I don't think that we would have thought maybe 6 months ago. But are you picking up warnings, warning flares going up among Republicans who are realizing that this map is a lot broader and a lot more dangerous than anybody would have thought a few months ago?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's been the way that Mitch McConnell has basically governed from the Senate for at least the last, month or month and a half, is out of a place of fear of losing the majority. And I think that the map's a lot broader than the Democrats thought they would have, and a lot broader than the Republicans thought they would be defending. And ultimately, what that means is there's a good chance of the Senate flipping the way the House did in 2018. And I think a lot of voters, even some who will vote for Donald Trump, want to make sure that there's some sort of check on him.
Yes. And also, do people actually think that way, by the way? I mean, do voters think in those terms?
Absolutely. Not all voters think in those terms. I mean, while we're talking about, 150 million people or so, maybe more, who will end up voting in 2020. And so, you can't characterize them all the same. But yes, when I talk to voters around the country, over the course of years, what I find is that there are people who are willing to split their tickets. You see this most pronounced in off-year elections rather than in the same election where they vote for president of one party and senator or house member of the other party at the same time. You'll see in midterm elections they decide to correct. But the Senate's only up, one-third of those seats every 2 years. So, I think you'll see some ticket splitting.
Well, and I
not a ton of it. It doesn't register as like the biggest percentage. We're still polarized.
Yeah.
But in a state like Montana, where
right,
John Tester won by a point or two last time, ticket splitting could matter.
In Montana, that poll, I think, took a lot of people by surprise. And if in fact the Democrats were to flip Montana, then you realize, I mean, game on. Because I mean that was not even remotely thought about, I would say late last year, until they finally got Governor Bullock to get out of the presidential race and jump into that Senate race. So the Democrats have actually done a pretty good job in places like Montana and Colorado of recruiting their strongest possible candidate, and that matters even in a year like this, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, first of all, what we've seen with Joe Biden on the vice presidential run in the primary, in the Democratic primaries, there's nothing like name recognition and a reputation that exists. So that same thing in a Montana Senate race or a Colorado Senate race, where you have somebody who has served as governor and has a reputation that is difficult for the other side to tear down quickly. And, both of those states are to different degrees, both of those states are very much in play. And there may even be some other surprises. I think the Republicans are going to have to work harder than they thought they would in South Carolina to keep Lindsey Graham in the Senate.
Isn't that something? I mean, the fact that even we're even talking about that is an indication of how things have shifted. So you're writing another book?
Yes, Amy Parnes and I are writing a book about the 2020 election, a postmortem, So we're not there yet.
Wow. No, you're not there. How do you write a book? It's funny that you've been bringing this up because I keep thinking, am I going to write another book? And you know, people ask me that. And I'll go, well, when we figure out what's going on. I have no idea at this particular moment. So that's a heavy lift to be writing about this race in the midst of this. And how do you go about doing that?
We'll see how it works. what we do is we do all the reporting that we can in real time about the decisions that are being made, and obviously trailing a little bit. Could have an interview today about something that happened in the New Hampshire primary or South Carolina or Super Tuesday or whatever. But the idea is to report it as it goes along, to get behind the scenes, to try to explain the decisions that are made. In the context of how they were being made at the time. And ideally what happens is the reader gets to read through the election with a peek behind the scenes, as it unfolds and without the sort of foreshadowing of, at least not the heavy foreshadowing of who won. And that's what we did with Shattered, and we felt like it was a pretty successful model.
No, that book made you feel like you were living through it in real time. And, sometimes history looks back and imposes a certain order on events that actually didn't exist. So, lived history going through all of this, I think is incredibly valuable, because I keep thinking, I wonder, how will historians be able to capture what the last 3 years have been like? What it was like living through 2017 when the world, things were shifting all of the time, because things will look inevitable. Things will have a certain order and a certain pattern that, as you and I know, does not actually exist in the real world. Well, good luck, Jonathan. Very much looking forward. Very much enjoyed Shattered. Very much looking forward to your next book, and really appreciate all your time this morning on the Bulwark Podcast.
Charlie, it's always a pleasure to be with you.
And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.